Hello, everyone. My name is Mike Riley, and I'd like to welcome you today to Robert Ringer's The Art of Recasting. Most of you are already familiar with Robert Ringer's history-making accomplishments over the past three decades. He is the author of eight books, including three number one bestsellers, two of which have been listed by the New York Times among the 15 best-selling motivational books of all time. On today's call, Robert and I will be discussing the art of recasting a business. We're going to cover why and how new successful businesses are able to succeed in spite of competition and tradition. We've got a lot of ground to cover today, so at this time, let's get started by turning things over to Robert Ringer.
Thanks, Mike. You know, people often get frustrated because they can't seem to come up with a unique idea for a product or business. I hear that and see that in so many emails. They feel like everything has already been tried or invented. You know that feeling?
Yes, I do.
And to an extent, you know, they're really right because everything has been tried. But what they don't understand is what my father used to refer to as man and method.
Man and method. What is that all about?
Well, when he used this phrase, Mike, he was talking about why one person fails while another person succeeds in the very same business.
That's very interesting. I mean, you can see that in all kinds of businesses.
Oh, absolutely. And it's one of the things that had most stuck with me. He was talking to me about it when I was a little kid, and I've always believed that his words had a lot to do with my being a maverick. It's just a real high for me, you know, to succeed at something that everyone says won't work.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
You know, I mean, I'm one guy who's heard it all. There's no market for it. The business model is flawed and so on. But the three I like best are, too many companies are already doing that, it's been tried before and it didn't work, or it's an outdated business. Now, let me tell you what I think about remarks like these. Number one, it doesn't matter how many other companies are already in a business. I know that flies in the face of conventional wisdom. It may sound shocking to some people. I tell you, it doesn't matter how many companies are already in a business.
Yeah.
Secondly, it doesn't matter how many other people have tried something and failed. Big mistake to let that dissuade you. And thirdly, there's no such thing as a quote-unquote outdated business. And I'm especially passionate about that one. All you need to focus on is doing something better or doing it different.
So when you say, for instance, trying something where people have failed, you're saying that just because somebody else failed doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to fail. Or maybe that you failed at one aspect of it doesn't mean you're going to fail at another aspect. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Absolutely. You can do something that someone else has done and do it the same way, but that's what man and method is all about. Why does one guy succeed and another guy fail? So it's all about you and your abilities and your vision and your ability to implement your ideas. So what I want to do on this call is offer up some classic examples to back up what I've just said. And I classify all of these examples under the heading of recasting existing business models. You know, there's an old saying, it's better to follow a pioneer than be a pioneer.
I mean, yeah,
you know,
indeed.
Exactly. You know, we've all heard about reinventing the wheel. Well, you may do something different, but you start on another person's shoulders because that other person may have stopped 3 feet short of the vein of gold, you know, the famous story.
Exactly.
So you start on his shoulders and you figure out, oh, if he would have just gone on from here and done this, that, or the other thing. So in other words, you take an existing business and you just do it a little better or you do it a little differently or both. And that's really what recasting is all about.
And that can be done with small businesses, and I'm sure large businesses do it. It could even be departments within a business, right?
Oh, it can be anything. In fact, one of the first examples I'm going to give, because it's amazing, you don't even think of it as a business, is being an airplane broker. No one
airplane.
Even thinks about that as a business.
No, I sure don't.
Yeah, well, you know, back when I owned a private jet, I came in contact with a lot of airplane brokers, and like brokers in any other business, they earn a commission on every sale. I'd say about 25 years ago, and I'm so mad that I didn't keep the article, but I still remember it vividly. I read a fascinating story in Fortune magazine about an airplane broker who had made $15 million the previous year selling used airplanes. You know, you're talking probably $30 or $40 million today. So this is a serious business.
Very serious.
So the figure was astonishing considering he was only a broker. And the guy's name escapes me now, and I even tried to Google it, but it was just impossible. You know, I don't know whether he's dead or what he's doing now, but I remember it was kind of a Polish or Hungarian name, started with a K, but I couldn't get the exact name. But what was interesting about this story, Mike, was that this airplane broker didn't work on a commission basis. Now, I've known a lot of airplane brokers over the years who made anywhere from $100,000 to $500,000 a year. You know, it's just like real estate brokers. It's very fat at the top. But what made this guy different is that he cleverly positioned himself as a principal rather than a broker. That was the whole deal. And he operated.
Principal.
Yeah.
He actually bought these things himself?
Well, he operated pretty much like the no money down real estate guys who are experts at so-called double closings, you know?
Yeah.
Here's the way it went. He stayed in contact with, you know, Middle Eastern sheiks and other wealthy people throughout the world. Also big corporations, anyone who was looking to buy a used jet aircraft, and he made it a point to find out what kind of plane they were interested in. So he was always on top of that. And then at the same time, he kept in close contact with people and companies that were interested in selling their airplanes. So far, it just sounds like a broker. Now, here's one of his keys to posturing himself as a principal. He never tried to get a listing agreement from the seller of an aircraft. Never had him sign anything. And that's because he positioned himself as a principal. So whenever he matched up a buyer and a seller, he would tie down the seller in writing at one price that he was the de facto purchaser, then get the buyer to sign a purchase agreement at a higher price, and the difference between the two figures represented his profit, which usually was many times greater than a normal aircraft brokerage commission would have been, maybe in the millions.
So the seller doesn't hire the broker, but the broker comes with a client in his back pocket and a contract.
Exactly.
And neither the buyer nor the seller feel that they're even paying him. Because
exactly.
Each agreed on the price that the deal's going to go down at.
Right. It's the best of all worlds, and he just... You know, you could do this literally with almost no money. And, again, the reason he was able to do this was because he positioned himself as a buyer and seller of aircraft rather than as a mere broker. So he simply did the aircraft brokerage business differently than the average broker. He just recast an old business. And what I recall about the Fortune article, however, is that this innovative broker said that he had created his own industry. And, you know, when I read that statement, I thought to myself, no, he hasn't created a new industry. What he's done is simply recast an existing industry. And I think that was the first time I ever used the word recasting. And from that point on, my mind just exploded, and it's still exploding today with all of the recasting possibilities, all the ramifications to this amazing philosophy, this concept.
Wow. You know, talking about this, it reminds me of your own involvement as a real estate broker. You kind of did similar things, right?
Well, yeah. As a matter of fact, it was, I guess that's one of the reasons I like the story. All I did, I was a real estate broker, but I positioned myself, as probably most people on the on this call know, as a buyer of properties. And I did have people sign, but my contracts were kind of interesting. I customized each contract, but I would go in acting as though I wanted to buy the property, and then would tell them, you know, if the property isn't right for me, that I would that I have a lot of people in the industry who I know who would be interested in selling, or excuse me, in buying, and then I would get the seller of the property to agree to sell at a certain price, even though I knew that if the deal was going to close, it was going to have to be at a much lower price. But the key was I got him to – it was a little bit different than the airplane broker, because I got him to agree to a specific commission no matter what the closing price was, because he'd always say, well, I won't close at any price but this anyway. Then if it closed for $200,000 or $300,000 less, he was still obligated in writing to pay me whatever my commission was, which was usually in the area of 5 or 6%, but it was somewhat similar to the airplane broker in that I posited myself as a buyer, as a principal, yeah, as a buyer.
The real estate industry today, you probably forged ground for this. There's a, I don't know if you call it a technique or a portion of the real estate investment industry that, particularly for beginners, called bird dogging. And what a bird dog does is it's very similar. He goes out and finds a very motivated seller, gives them a contract, and signs the contract, but in the contract there is an escape clause or two. But his intent is to not actually go to closing and take title of the property. The bird dog's real purpose in life is to go to his list of buyers and say, look, I got a terrific deal here. And then he sells it to them for, you know, whatever his he wants his commission to be, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000.
Right, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
Just saying, it's very similar.
Same thing. He's positioning himself differently, and he certainly deserves his fee because any way you slice it, he's the one who went out and got the buyer.
That's
now,
it.
You know, speaking of what I did in the real estate industry, that reminds me, I really did the same thing, I would argue, in the in the book publishing and book selling industry. Because, as I think everyone knows by now, I self-published my first three books, and no one had ever sold books on their own through full-page ads, particularly in the Wall Street Journal, before. So I was just another author, another guy trying to market my books, but I tried it a different way, and it was what I called perception preceding reality, where I created these ads that made the book sound so big that people couldn't resist buying it, and as a result, the reality eventually caught up with the perception. And that kind of leads me into another example, which is really just an incredible story of recasting, and that's the story of Steve Riggio, who is the founder of Barnes & Noble. Now, I don't know how book publishers ever got themselves trapped into such a bad deal, and a lot of people don't know that. I'd say most people don't know this, but the accepted way of doing business in the book industry has always been for publishers to sell their books to bookstores on a consignment basis, meaning that if the books don't sell, the bookstores can return them for full credit.
You're kidding me.
Oh, absolutely. And when people hear this for the first time, they're usually astonished. Now, this has always been a bad side of the publishing business, but I guess the reason publishers were able to live with the consignment arrangement was because they were so powerful they could really pushed the bookstores around, particularly the little bookstores. This was before large bookstore chains came into existence, and bookstores were afraid to return too many books to a powerhouse, you know, publisher like Random House or Simon & Schuster, because they were concerned about being cut off from future shipments.
So it was an intimidation technique.
Oh, definitely. So it was kind of a what you'd call a balance of power, and then along came Walden Books, who at their high, they were the leader in the industry in the 70s and the early 80s, maybe mid-80s, with about 2,000 stores, and B. Dalton with almost 1,000 stores. And a lot of these big chains started developing, and things started to change. And bookstores started becoming more powerful. Well, then in the 1980s, a true recasting genius by the name of Leonard Riggio came along. Now, he didn't come busting on the scene, which is what I really admire about him. He just bought a little bookstore company called Barnes & Noble. Nobody really had ever heard of it at the time. And it was kind of a non-event in the retail book industry. And this would make a great movie because no one even paid attention to him and his little chain of bookstores until at least the mid-1980s. And what I admire about him is that he moved quietly and cleverly until little by little, Barnes & Noble maneuvered itself into a position where it was able to tighten its control over what I call the gates that stand between book publishers and book customers. Now, all along the way, Barnes & Noble bought up small bookstores and chains. You know, they're doing this quietly, and then one day Riggio buys B. Dalton and then Doubleday. And it seems incredible now, but the large publishers didn't even see what was coming. This is the power of the zip the lip theory that I've written about so often in the past. If you've got something good going, shut up and
shut
say,
up and just do it.
Oh, this was really low key. I remember going up to see Riggio back in the late 80s. Late 80s is when I went up there. And they had these old decrepit offices. I believe it's around 5th and 20th Street in New York. Like an old warehouse almost. And low overhead, quiet operation. And now as Barnes & Noble grew and became more and more powerful, Riggio got the financing to start building superstores, which we're all familiar with today. And Barnes & Noble has about 700 of these monster retail outlets spread throughout every major metropolitan area in the United States. So it was a classic job of recasting with a master plan to become the industry's gatekeeper. And what happened, Mike, is his success changed the dynamics of the entire retail book industry. I should also mention two other little twists that Riggio added in his recasting efforts. Now, remember, these are all things no one had ever done before. First, he put small cafes in his superstores, which, of course, everyone is familiar with today.
Yep.
I think a lot of the stores have Starbucks in them.
And Barnes & Noble was first to do that?
As far as I know, Barnes & Noble was the first to do it.
This
would have sounded crazy in earlier days, but now the reason seems obvious. It was so customers could have donuts and coffee or pie or whatever without ever having to leave the store. The whole idea was to keep the customer in the store.
Yeah.
Now, playing right into that,
keeping customers on your website. When you have a website.
Same principle.
Same concept.
Except
we can't serve coffee, right?
Right. So now what's the second thing he does? He has overstuffed lounge chairs strategically placed throughout each store so customers could relax and just read to their heart's content. No one had ever heard of such a thing in major bookstores before. So a guy's just sitting around. He's drinking coffee. He's lounging in a chair. He's reading a book and decides, hey, he likes the book. He buys it. Now, just think about this for a moment. Riggio went into a dull, centuries-old business and totally recast it. It was a classic example of the man and method my dad used to talk to me about. He just did things differently than anyone had ever done them before in the retail book industry. But it was a dull industry. And by the time publishers woke up to what was going on, guess what? It was too late.
Too late.
Today, if a publisher wants a book to be given nationwide exposure, it has to pay the gatekeeper, and the gatekeeper is Barnes & Noble. In fact, everyone knows you can't get on the New York Times bestseller list if your book isn't in Barnes & Noble. You can sell 10 million books, and it's not going to make it.
I'll be darned.
So Barnes & Noble became the gatekeeper, and if a publisher wants decent placement for any particular book in Barnes & Noble superstores, and believe me, I know because I paid the freight, it has to be prepared to come up with big bucks. And let me give you an example. If a publisher wants one of its books to appear, let's say, on the third table from the front of the store at all the Barnes & Noble outlets, it has to pay extra for that privilege. Or if it wants the book to appear on the front table, that's even more expensive. Or even to have the book placed on the so-called end rack. You know, there's little racks like on the end of each bookshelf at a Barnes & Noble store. That costs money. You don't get anything for free. Otherwise, you're just thrown in with all the other books.
So you pay for position.
You pay for position. And, of course, there are the special racks, and everyone has seen them, that are filled with just a single title. Let me tell you, these things cost a king's ransom to rent. This guy had figured it out and has it going on every angle, whereas before people just had these little bookstores, and people came in, and if they were lucky, they bought a book. And he took an existing business and did it completely differently. So all Riggio really did was, as far as charging for book placement, is he copied the legal bribery system that has been used by supermarkets for decades.
If
you go to a supermarket, I think everybody understands, wherever you see a display of, say, Pepsi or Coke, those companies paid serious money for that placement in that particular store. So when it comes to recasting, having the resourcefulness to take an idea used in one industry and adapt it to another industry is really a crucial skill. Riggio took one very old industry, bookselling, and applied a method of operation used by another very old industry, supermarkets, and the combination was worth a fortune.
And you know what? I think the supermarkets turned it around on him. He had the great idea of putting in a coffee shop in the store, and now the supermarkets, like in our area, we have giant supermarkets. They have banks in their stores. They have Staples office supplies in their stores.
Oh, everyone's gotten smart. It's the way all retailing has gone now. So if you can expand your mental paradigm to think like this, the possibilities for you to recast an existing business are endless. And I don't care what kind of business you're in. I don't care what kind of business you're thinking of. Trust my dad. It's a matter of man and method.
So if you have a bakery, for instance, maybe you ought to think about adding a coffee shop. Or if you have a ice cream store, you could think about adding as a product line, books to read while you're eating ice cream. Of course, that'd be pretty
turn it right around. Absolutely, absolutely. There is no limit. You know, it's as big as your mind is resourceful. There's no limit to what you can do. The only requirement I think is you have to be passionate about it. But boy, the more you can do something different, something that's never been done before, but in businesses that are old, businesses that other people have tried, or businesses where there are a lot of other companies involved, and just do it different, and you're going to stand out like a sore thumb.
Speaking of old industries, I think one of the oldest industries around is barbershops. You know, they've been around since people started growing hair, right?
Right.
I saw on TV the other day an idea that just blew me away. I mean, how basic is a business that can you get as a business than a barbershop? And there's not too much that you can do with that other than stand there and cut hair. But the difference that I saw on TV was instead of the customer going to the barbershop for a haircut, this innovative barber took his barber chairs and put them on little carts and pushed these carts around the streets of Hong Kong, giving haircuts right there on the street. He took the barber chair to the customer. And I just flipped out when I saw that.
That's fantastic. Yeah, there. You have to think in terms of there are no boundaries. You can just do whatever you want. Do any, you know, do crazy things. Try something different. Let me tell you, publishers haven't even come close to figuring out a way to deal with Leonard Riggio's way of doing business. And because he's created a real monster. And to make matters worse, Borders, Walden Books, and Books A Million, I guess the next three largest chains, of course, they've all imitated Barnes & Noble because the gatekeeper system works. So publishers really, these are not good times for publishers. And oh, by the way, you'd think things couldn't get any worse for publishers, but guess what happened about 5 years ago, Mike?
What?
Barnes & Noble expanded into the publishing business to compete with its own customers.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I don't know where all this is going, but I do know that it all started with Leonard Riggio having an idea about how to recast a very dull, very old business and taking action on that idea. Now, the lesson all us guys on the sidelines can learn from Leonard Riggio is that no one has such a stranglehold on any industry that they're immune to new competition. Especially if the giants in an industry are arrogant, which, trust me, is almost always the case. So don't let anyone discourage you. If your plan is clever enough, and if you're prepared to do whatever it takes to execute it, anything is possible. It truly is man and method.
Well, all I can say is those publishers need to think about recasting themselves.
For sure.
All right, now, I've heard you talk about Steve Wynn before. He's one of your favorite stories. How does Steve Wynn's history in the Las Vegas fit into this?
Oh yeah, he's right up there with Riggio, a really amazing man, and quite, as most people know, quite flamboyant too. Whereas Riggio is very quiet, Steve Wynn has always been very flamboyant.
Just the opposite.
Oh, yeah. I think most people are probably too young to remember the good old days in Las Vegas when men wore coats and ties and women wore fine dresses in the casinos and hotel restaurants. And, you know, if you wanted to sit in the front row to see Elvis or Sinatra, you just slipped the maitre d' $50 and he sat you at a stage side table. Oh, it was great. I mean, I remember sitting in the front row twice to see Elvis. I sat in the front row to see Tom Jones. You know, if you're willing to pay the money, it slips you right up front. But it's in the 1980s, Las Vegas fell on hard times. Some people may remember that. And I can remember reading in the paper expert after expert saying that the whole concept of Vegas was outdated and that more and more casinos were going to go bankrupt. And, in fact, at that time, in the late 80s, there hadn't been a new luxury hotel built in Las Vegas since the MGM Grand in 1980. I remember when that was built, right across from Caesar's Palace. I'm talking about the original MGM Grand, not the one that's now at the corner of Tropicana.
Right.
And
right there.
At the one on Tropicana?
Yeah, the one that was across from Caesar's
Palace. Palace, right. That was the original one. I think it's Bally's now. I'm not sure. It's one of the hotels where they had the fire. And you know what caused everything to change? A guy named Steve Wynn, who had a vision of a very different kind of Las Vegas. And I don't know if this was all pre-planned or it just unfolded as he went along, but what he saw was a rigid corporate structure that marketed to the masses. You have to remember that Las Vegas started out as basically mafia territories run by the mafia.
Yeah.
And as they got weeded out and little by little, and in fact, Wynn filed a suit against someone who had written an article about him or a book about him, I've forgotten which it was, saying that he was involved with the mafia, and I guess he wasn't. He filed a huge lawsuit and he won. He was just a young guy when he came to Las Vegas, and he was the son of a bingo parlor operator who, believe it or not, was from Baltimore. And he hustled his way around Las Vegas in his 20s, and he eventually gained a controlling interest in the public company that owned the Golden Nugget in downtown Las Vegas. I remember the Golden Nugget was kind of a sleazy place, like most downtown hotels in Vegas, and he had it completely remodeled into a beautiful hotel. And I don't know how he pulled it off, but he became chairman at the age of 31.
Wow.
And this was a young kid. And I remember when this was going on, but it was after the Golden Nugget became a major success that Wynn really showed his recasting genius. And that was in 1989 when he built his first strip hotel. And probably most everybody on the phone does remember this. It was the Mirage.
The Mirage, yep.
And it was practically right next to Caesar's Palace. You know, it had the volcano out front. Nobody had ever seen anything like it that went off every hour or whatever. And even though this may sound like, oh, this is over my head and everything, it's not the level on which he played this game. It's understanding this whole concept of daring to go into an existing business and doing things totally differently because, let me tell you something, it'll get you attention. This was in 1989, and what was amazing is that it was a smack in the face of all the negative talk about Las Vegas and hard times and the city was outdated, and Wynn succeeded, and I remember this clearly also, in raising $600 million, most of it through junk bonds that was sold to him by Michael Milken. And I'm sure everybody remembers when Milken was the king of the hill and selling junk bonds, and he ended up going to prison, which was kind of a bad rap because he probably indirectly put hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people to work. But
wow.
He's the one who actually got Wynn started, and he financed most of the building of the Mirage Hotel. Now, just by coincidence, and it's strictly a coincidence, I happened to stay at the Mirage, I think, the second day after it opened. I believe it opened on like a Friday, and I stayed there on a Saturday because I had just moved to Las Vegas, and my home wasn't ready. And I can tell you that the majority opinion was that the hotel was not going to survive. There was no way possible. And I recall reading a story in the Wall Street Journal about Wynn, and it pointed out, and the Mirage, and it pointed out the Mirage would need to do $1 million a day in business, which was totally unheard of at that time, just to break even. I mean, that's all anybody was talking about. How's this place ever going to do $1 million a day? Now, of course, the Mirage not only ended up prospering, but it spawned a nonstop building boom in Vegas, and I was there through a big part of it in the 90s that's still going on even today. So what Wynn did with the Mirage is transform an entire city and the way people around the world viewed that city. No one had ever seen anything like this in Las Vegas. The point is that Las Vegas has always had luxury hotels. Everybody knows that. But Wynn recast the luxury hotel into a mega luxurious, mega themed, self-contained resort with a family environment. That was one thing that was really, really new, was the family environment, because it was always thought of as an adult place. And the second thing that I think was even more important is he applied tight corporate controls in a business that, because it had started out with the mafia, was very loosely controlled. And I lived in Las Vegas for a number of years, and I can tell you that the giant gaming corporations are in total control of anything and everything that goes on there. I mean, the politicians totally protect the gaming industry. The gaming industry is always right. Everyone else is always wrong. And he saw this, and he started to get a foothold. And after the Mirage's success in 1993, Wynn opened the Treasure Island Hotel right next door. And, of course, that was totally different with the pirate shows in front and a life-size ship. And it was right on the strip. I mean, people had never seen anything like this. And, of course, after that, the Bellagio, which was the ultimate luxury hotel, and Wynn Las Vegas. And he started building hotels throughout the country and around the world. And, of course, to understand the scope of how much Wynn changed Las Vegas, the paintings in the Bellagio's art gallery cost more than it cost to build an entire Las Vegas hotel in the good old days.
I've seen those paintings. I know.
Oh, this was a guy who, he came in, changed the whole business.
Well, you know, I know this is off the topic, really, but the chandelier in the Bellagio cost $10 million for the main chandelier.
Isn't that amazing? It makes you suspect there might be a little bit of profit in the gaming business, huh?
Well, as a matter of fact, I remember taking a cab one time from the airport, and the cab driver said to me, he says, Steve Wynn has a philosophy as to how, or has a secret as to how to win at gambling. And I said, oh, yeah, what's that? He said, own a casino.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, as I said, his dad was a bingo parlor operator, and my understanding is he was a compulsive gambler, so he probably learned his lesson through his father.
Yeah, he probably did.
You know, getting back to this corporate structure, long before he built the Bellagio, Wynn had already succeeded in forcing the gaming industry in Las Vegas into conforming to his corporate structure model. And this is what really just changed Vegas. It was those two things, marketing to the masses and the tight corporate structure. When he was just catering to the rich, they wouldn't have stood for it. You know, they were not going to be fit into a mold. And he just manipulated the entire gaming industry to his way of thinking. And once he built the Mirage, it took him just a few short years to eliminate the old maitre d' tipping system and replace it with a real tightly controlled situation in the theaters where people had to buy a ticket for a specific seat. I remember, I didn't even know that was happening, and I remember going to a show once, and I just walked up and was expecting to hand the maitre d' some money. Maitre d' told me I'd have to go to the window and buy a ticket, and it was for a specific seat, just like going to a football game or something.
Wow.
So it was just remarkable. I mean, totally changed an industry. And his success in bending the desert establishment to his way of thinking was, in my view, one of the most remarkable entrepreneurial achievements in history. Never saw anything like it. And to me, it was the most significant part of his recasting because, in effect, he reinvented the entire gaming industry. And as I said, the second major recasting job he did was to turn it into an entertainment mecca for the masses. Now, you could argue whether Kurt Kerkorian, who now owns most of Wynn's hotels, by the way, Kurt Kerkorian, I think, is 90 or 91 years old now and just getting started. But I think the two of them together saw that the money was to be made in the masses, kind of that philosophy, bring your paycheck and preferably as much of your dwindling savings as possible, and your whole family is welcome. So it's kind of nostalgic for me. The coats and ties are now just a distant memory, and when you go to Las Vegas today, you see parading up and down the strip the sloppy-fitting Abercrombie and Fitch T-shirts made in Pakistan and the sloppy khaki shorts made in the Philippines and an army of junk food addicts wearing them. It's almost like a different city, really. And plus, when I started going there, Las Vegas, I think the first time I was there, it had a population of about 100,000. And I think today, well, of course, it's the fastest growing city in the United States today. That's no secret. But I think it, by 2010, it's going to have something like 3 million people. So, and Wynn had a big part to play in this. I don't know whether, as I said earlier, whether Wynn had a grandiose plan to change the way Vegas operated, or if events just sort of unfolded for him as things went along. But, you know, either way, he proved that every industry is vulnerable to resourceful entrepreneurs. And in this case, his resourcefulness resulted in his becoming a billionaire when he sold his Mirage Resorts group of hotels to Kirk Kerkorian's MGM Grand in 2000. And of course, he's off, you know, on other things now.
Well, you know, that whole thing just, now that's on a huge, as you said, grandiose scale that not too many of us can really relate to. But it makes me think, I mean, he goes into an old town with old customs, with old clientele, that things have been done this way for years and years and years, and he changes it entirely with new products and services and new delivery methods, man and method, as you say. It makes me think of these hamburger joints, you know. How many different hamburger joints can there be? And apparently the answer is it's unlimited.
Endless.
I mean, everybody can do it different. You got Checkers, who has no dining room. It's two drive-up windows and no place to sit down and eat. Then you got Wendy's, who for some reason thinks that square hamburgers are better than round hamburgers. And Burger King with flame broiled, etc. And
Cheeseburger, totally different concept.
Just a totally different concept.
I guarantee you that's going to end up being a multi-billion dollar deal, especially if the economy keeps going where I think it's going. And then, of course, our favorite, I think your favorite is the same as mine, in the D.C. area of Five Guys.
Oh, Five Guys,
and
yeah.
I think, how could somebody just go into the hamburger business in the D.C. area? And I didn't even realize how big Five Guys is, and I didn't realize, are you aware, Mike, that they're not just in the D.C. area now?
Yeah, I've heard that they've at least spread down south into the Carolinas and stuff.
Yeah, I know they have places in Atlanta, and I asked one of the they're also franchising them, and I asked one of the owners how many stores they had. I thought they had like 20 or 25 stores in the area, and they've got something like 200 or 250 stores just in the D.C. area. Now, though, not many folks on the line would be familiar with Five Guys, but here's what's important. Here's what's important with this story. It's the exact opposite of Steve Wynn's story. You see, when it comes to recasting, folks, anything goes. There are no rules. And Five Guys, instead of being opulent, did the exact opposite thing. They just restrict their menu to burgers, hot dogs, French fries, and soft drinks. Am I forgetting anything, Mike? They have no salads, no milkshakes, nothing.
But they give you peanuts.
And they give you free peanuts. Yeah, that's a whole other story. And they just happen to cook a phenomenal hamburger. And this is important, too, because it's attention to the little things. And, of course, Mike, working with me, you know how I feel about this. It's the little things that make the difference. And they are the only hamburger place I've ever known who cores the tomatoes. Because when I bite into a hamburger and it's got the core in the tomato there, I'm ready to jump over the counter and go after the guy who's cooking the hamburgers, or at least the person who put the stuff on. But they do those little things. It's those little things that make the difference. And it's like, we're simple. That's it, folks. We just cook hamburgers, and it happens to be the best hamburger made. And if
you just brought up another whole thing here that is so obvious, and I just thought of it. You mentioned it, and that's Robert Ringer. I mean, the reason Robert Ringer is a successful author is because he does things different. You go on the internet and you find people can write various articles about different subjects, but there are not many, if any, authors, serious authors, that put out the kind of well-written, I mean, folks, if you only knew Robert Ringer and how, what should I say, picky? It sounds like such a low word, but, I mean, you pay attention to details like nobody I have ever known.
It's attention
to detail,
yeah. And I
believe in that. You don't notice a detail. you notice the product, the finished product seems so polished and beautiful, but you don't know how it got polished. You know, you don't know what's making it that way.
Well, and
that's
what's
beautiful.
Yeah, and I appreciate the those remarks. Obviously, I'm not going to comment on those, but I've told people for years, like when it comes to writing, if you read something that reads simple, it's not because the person dashed it off fast. If it reads simple, if it's just seems to be really smooth, it's because the author put a lot of time into it. But I would argue it's that way, you know, with everything.
With every product.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, places where is it Burger King where they cook the order, or is it Wendy's?
Yeah, well, they used to advertise "Have it your way."
Yeah,
but I don't know that they do that. I guess you can still do it that way.
But attention to details, everything. That's a whole other subject that I'd like to spend a whole hour on, because I think it's, if you do nothing more than that, you almost have to succeed by accident.
But that alone, that is one facet of recasting a business. You could take whatever business you're in and look at your competition and find out how sloppy they are and polish up the sloppy area and begin winning that part of the business.
I'll tell you, that an excellent point, Mike, because what you should do in any business you're thinking about going into, just check out the competition, and if you're detail-oriented at all, if you're quality-oriented at all, you'll be shocked at how sloppy most places operate. In fact, what always has encouraged me is to see how businesses that are very mediocre seem to succeed in a big way. And I'm not going to name any names because I don't want to insult anybody, but you and I have talked about them a lot, Mike.
Yep.
It really doesn't take very much to succeed. And the more you polish your stuff, the more different you are, the more quality, the more attention to detail, the easier it is to distance yourself from the competition. Which reminds me, we were talking just a little while ago about Steve Wynn becoming a billionaire finally after all these years. And speaking of billionaires, perhaps the most remarkable recasting story of all is that of Starbucks. In fact, my most favorite recasting story is how Howard Schultz built Starbucks into a worldwide phenomenon in an incredibly short period of time. And I just, for those who don't know this story, I just want to give a cursory overview of it. When Schultz was very young, just a young guy, he was a coffee maker salesman. I mean, and he came from a very poor background. He lived in a tenement house. I think it was in the Bronx. And it was really just a pathetic existence. And he got out the West Coast, and he happened to pay a sales visit to a coffee bean shop in Seattle by the name of Starbucks. You talk about fate, but for whatever reason, he immediately fell in love with the atmosphere of the place, and he ended up working there. He got it, talked him into getting a job there. And by the way, it's a great example of somebody who took action, quit his job, felt it in his gut, got a job there. And after a while, he came up with the idea of opening a coffee bar on the premises, but the owners turned down his idea because he said they didn't want to get into the restaurant business. You know, a lot of people don't like the restaurant business because it's so labor-intensive and you got to just be on top of it all the time. And Schultz had this vision in his head. I don't know where it came from, but he had this vision, and so he left Starbucks and he opened up his own coffee shop, just a little place called the Two Giornali there in Seattle. And as a few years went by, Starbucks expanded to 6 stores, and it was very profitable. And in 1987, the owners wanted to retire, so they offered to sell their stores to Schultz for $3.8 million, which was a king's ransom at the time. Now, to really appreciate... Yeah, they just... But this was coffee bean sales. It was just retail sales. It wasn't coffee shops at the time.
It was just the beans, right.
Yeah, he had the little coffee shop, but they knew that that's what he wanted to do, and they said, hey, $3.8 million, I don't know how they arrived at the figure, you can have it. So to really appreciate this story, you have to keep in mind that this came at a time, and this is so important to understand this for people who are easily intimidated and discouraged by the so-called discouragement fraternity, that it came at a time when coffee sales were down in the U.S. and coffee shops were becoming extinct. I mean, Who had time to sit down in a coffee shop? The world was moving too fast for people to slow down and relax and have a cup of coffee like they did in the old days, right?
Exactly.
So what I want to say is it's precisely, emphasized precisely, in situations like this that a contrarian thinker has the opportunity to make a fortune. Why? Because everyone else is going in the opposite direction. So if you want to go where the competition isn't, you go in the other direction. And Schultz had this recasting vision, and he used his sales and marketing skills to transform that vision into reality. And as I've taught so many times in the past, when he applied action to his vision, I really believe that he drew to himself the things, people, and circumstances he needed to transform his vision into a tangible reality. It works every time. So Schultz,
wow.
It's just an amazing story. I wish we had an hour just to talk about this. But he had an invaluable asset also that I think most entrepreneurs possess, and that's a Yiddish word called chutzpah. And, I mean, he's got it in spades. If you just stop to think about it, here he is in the face of declining coffee sales in the U.S. The guy had the nerve to charge $3 for a cup of coffee, a cup of the world's dullest drink and most common drink, at a time when you could probably get coffee for what? I don't know, Mike. I'm not a coffee drinker. For a quarter, half dollar?
Yeah, it was climbing up to 75 cents.
Okay, maybe. So, and he's charging $3, and he had the audacity to serve it in a paper cup. And what a result. As I said, Starbucks may be the biggest, fastest, non-high-tech success story in history. You know, I always tell people, when I moved to New Zealand in 1993, I had never heard of Starbucks, never seen one of its stores. But when I came back to the States a few years later, I'd be at a shopping center, and they were everywhere. And I wondered, what the heck is this? I've never seen this before. And, of course, today everyone knows the story. They sell 250 million gallons of coffee a day. They serve more than 50 million customers a week, more than 13,000 stores in 40 countries. And these figures may be outdated because they're opening 5 new stores a day and more than $30 billion in sales. And Schultz is doing this in an industry that the experts considered to be dead when he started his venture. So what Schultz did, you just have to realize what he did, it wasn't magic. He recast the coffee shop business, which is the smallest of the smallest businesses, and changed people's perception of coffee as a dull drink to what he likes to call, quote-unquote, designer coffee. It's really mind-boggling, but I've read that Starbucks now has 55,000 possible drink combinations. That's really hard
to
fathom.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And, again, I'm not a coffee drinker, so I don't know how they do it, but he's literally developed what he calls a coffee culture by making coffee sexy. So he took a dull industry and he made it sexy. And like the airplane broker I mentioned earlier, he created a new business by simply recasting an old business. And I think Schultz sums it up perfectly when he says that Starbucks, their approach has been unique and different. He says, not better, just different. And that tells you all you need to know about recasting. And if you want to know in dollars and cents what recasting can be worth, I'm told that a $10,000 investment in Starbucks in 1987 would be worth $5 million today.
Wow.
20 years, a little over 20 years. That's a return of 500 times on an investor's original money. Not a bad return for recasting.
If only you could see the future, right?
Yeah, well, apparently he did. And the future for an entrepreneur really gets down to a matter of having a vision on how to take something and make it different or better or both than anyone's ever done it before.
And, you know, he did a similar thing to Riggio. Riggio had his bookstores with a coffee shop. Here's a guy with a coffee shop, and he made a place for people to meet again. You know, you say it was kind of hard times for the coffee business. They were all closing up. Well, businessmen had a hard time finding places to meet,
exactly,
sit down and have a cup of coffee and do business.
You and I have met people. You and I have met people at Starbucks. I don't drink coffee.
Exactly, because it's a great place to meet. It also reminds me of Tom Monahan and his pizza business in times of hard times. Nobody delivered anything back during the 70s when the gas crisis was going on. You couldn't get anything delivered to your door. And Tom Monahan said, well, all people are going this way. I better go the other way. And he said, pizza for in 30 minutes or less, or it's free. And who I don't need to say the rest of the story, right?
Well, it's such a classic example because he just went in the pizza business but said, I'll deliver it. Today
exactly.
It sounds like, what's the big deal? Well, it was a big deal when he did it because nobody had done it before.
Exactly.
Since then, you see other pizza places like California Kitchen Pizza. What's different about them? Well, there's an example of they just did it much, much better. It's almost like gourmet pizza, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And now they got places all over the country. And I lived in Beverly Hills at the time when they opened their first place. Coincidentally, the Cheesecake Factory opened its first little restaurant, nothing like the restaurants you see today, and on Beverly Drive, on South Beverly Drive, south of Wilshire, the California Kitchen Pizza opened its first place. And Tony Romo opened his first place on Beverly Drive. So it seems to be a good place to start a business. But
well, it shows
I think
you
the whole concept was to just do it better.
Or you do it differently. As we're seeing here, it doesn't matter what industry it is. It doesn't matter what product it is. It just matters that if you want a slice of the pie, you can get it by doing things different than the competition. And then, of course, making yourself known in that area.
Absolutely. And this whole idea that I'm really trying to hammer home, this idea of taking dull businesses, you know, coffee is dull. The only business I can think of that could be more dull than selling cups of coffee would be the retail merchandising business. You know, it goes back to Middle Eastern merchants thousands of years ago. I mean, it's the oldest business, well, second oldest business in the world. But people take Walmart for granted, but I lived through the whole thing from the time it started, and I followed them very, very closely, I think when nobody cared about it. And it's a recasting of an old industry. And the discount store business is just so dull. I remember when discounters started exploding back in the 60s, and they were all over the place. But we're talking Bentonville, Arkansas.
Wow.
What did Bentonville have, a couple thousand population?
I don't know.
Like that?
Was it downtown Bentonville? Did they have a downtown?
Wasn't a lot. Listen, I lived in Arkansas for 6 months when I was stationed at Fort Chaffee, and I won the war there, as a matter of fact. Bentonville's got to be a small place. But, I mean, you got to be kidding. Walmart is just a classic example of man and method. That's a tough, tough business. And why in the world would a guy want to go into the discount store business at all, let alone in towns with populations of no more than 5,000 people? I don't know if everyone on the line realizes that for the first, I don't know the exact number of years, but I'm going to guess 15 to 20 years in business, Walmart never opened a store in a town of more than 5,000 people. That was their niche. They had a market niche. And
I remember that.
You remember that? It's a fascinating recasting strategy because Sam Walton was able to sneak in under the radar, kind of like Riggio did. But he was out of sight of big city discounters. And by the time he finally came out of hiding and descended on the big cities, it was too late for his competitors to react. I was surprised when I found out that they had started to go into big cities. And, you know, there's a really interesting story, Mike, in Sam Walton's biography. It's a great book. If anyone hasn't read it, I'd recommend you go out and buy it. It's very inspiring. And he was still only a little regional guy, you know, with about 30 stores. And so he made a trip to New York in the hopes of learning something from the big city discounters, you know, the guys who had all the answers. And he managed to get an appointment with an executive at one of the country's major discount chains. His whole story is told in his book, in his biography. And when he met with this guy, he pulled out some crumpled papers from his breast pocket of his suit, and he showed them to the guy and wanted him to give him some advice on how he could increase his bottom line. And because he had these handwritten sales and profit figures for his small town chain of stores. So the executive kind of perused the figures for a few minutes, and as the story goes, he kind of peered up over his glasses, and he shoved the papers back to Walton real quick, and he urged him not to show the figures to anyone else and not to try to get information from any other discounters. And he said, look, my advice to you is these figures are real. He said, you should turn around, go back to Arkansas as fast as you can get there, and keep doing whatever it is you've been doing to produce the kind of results you're showing on those papers. And he assured Walton that, and this is the old story of always thinking, oh, the experts know so much more than me, and you get intimidated. Well, he assured Walton, and he was with a major discounter, that no one in New York was even close to achieving the kind of numbers that he was producing in his small-town chain of stores. And he was obviously right, because in a relatively short period of time, and I spent a lot of time in New York during this period, but many of the biggest discounters in New York, people in the area would remember stores like E.J. Corvette and Alexander's. They start closing their doors. You know, they couldn't meet the competition. And, in fact, those old enough to remember know that it was a bloodbath for major discounters throughout the country for a couple of decades. And in retrospect, it's quite humorous that Sam Walton was trying to find out how the big guys got so big, considering that most of them went broke, and he ended up becoming the largest retailer in the world.
That's
so
amazing.
Another classic example of recasting a very old and very dull business into a multi-billion dollar success.
And then that spawned into these big box stores, you know, the Costco's,
right,
and of course now Sam's Club. I mean,
Which
literally
another example of recasting.
Yeah, exactly. Because Walmart, from what I understand, they don't warehouse anything. Right? I mean, they don't carry inventory that's not on the shelf in their store.
Right. They just, those trucks come in every day. I think they just have trucks coming in every day. It's some kind of an incredible system. And
if it don't sell, if it doesn't sell, they either mark it down or get rid of it.
For sure.
Turn the shelves over.
And you know, before we close, we ought to look at the other side of the coin, which is a high tech business, because it's one that's dear to my heart. Because it reminds me so much of what I used to do when I was selling my books on my own before a publisher came in and took over, a distributor actually came in and took over. But Jeff Bezos had a recasting vision of replacing bookstores, old-fashioned bookstores, with a centralized sales and shipping center by using the Internet. So here Riggio did his thing and was doing his thing in the 90s, and Bezos, this is really inspiring, he's coming along, and he's also attacking the bookstore industry, but from a totally different perspective.
Yeah.
And what he did, the guy did quite a study on this, and he recognized that to get new customers, retailers like Sears and Walmart had to build new stores, which cost millions of dollars, right?
Right.
But in Bezos' recasting vision, serving a new customers cost next to nothing. I mean, again, it sounds simple now, but he figured all this out back in the mid-90s. And, you know, recasting it is at its best when you connect two separate concepts. And I talked about that with the supermarkets. And in this case, he connected the Internet and retailing. And you have to go with your instincts and not what others say or what others have done before. And if your instincts take you in a lonely direction, that's probably a good sign. I can't imagine anyone, I've thought about this so many times over the years, can't imagine anyone who would have thought a dull business like selling books could be an online success. But Bezos went with his gut, and as a result, Amazon.com was born. And it just took off like wildfire. I think, I forgot the exact figures, but I think the first week, just through word of mouth with friends, sold a couple thousand copies, and the first month he sold 50,000 copies and exploded to 250,000, and nobody had ever done it before. So when Jeff Bezos was launching Amazon.com a decade ago, you have to understand that the largest physical bookstores had 30 to 50,000 titles in stock. What Bezos did was take what he calls, and these are his words, the bold, stupid path, and he stocked his shelves with 1 million titles.
Oh, my God.
And that's what attracted me to Amazon. If you wanted to get an old book like How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World, you're probably not going to find it in a bookstore. But Bezos was saying, we'll get you anything. And I know how he did it. And I know the reason he moved from New Mexico to Seattle, it wasn't because Microsoft was there. It was because one of the largest, I think the largest, Ingram book distributor, wholesale distributor, had their warehouse in Seattle. And what he wanted to do was sell the books, kind of like double closing. And then he'd run down every day, take his cash, get the titles from the wholesaler, run back, get down on his knees in his garage, and wrap the books himself and send them out. And within 2 years, they were doing $1 billion from that humble beginning.
Oh, my gosh.
It's a phenomenal story. And, again, I would advise anyone to read up on it if you really want to get inspired. Today, they probably advertise 10 million titles as opposed to 35,000 to 50,000 in the largest stores. And of course, also, today, Amazon.com is a lot more than books because, you know, all those years when Amazon wasn't profitable and people couldn't understand how they can stay in business, well, one of his great talents was he was able to sell his vision to Wall Street over and over again and raise billions of dollars because they recognized early on he had a list base of about 6 million people, and they recognized how valuable that was. And today, of course, it's profitable. And instead of just 6 or 8 or 10 million book titles that you can buy, Amazon sells more than 25 million products. And as I said, it's become a profitable business.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, we could go on and on with this. Century 21, McDonald's, et cetera. But how
and
about
Disneyland.
The part...
Don't forget Disneyland, Mike. A lot of people don't realize Disneyland. You know what Disneyland is?
What?
It's an amusement park that was coupled with an idea, shopping centers. Think about this tonight when you get off this call. Think about this. Disneyland is nothing more than the world's largest shopping center. The amusement park brings people in, and they sell and sell and sell merchandise all day and all night.
And they charge you to get in.
And they charge you to get in, exactly.
And park your car.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, Robert, this has just been a terrific call here. And we are so short on time, but how about some parting advice on this whole subject? Can you just kind of bring it in so folks can maybe take some of this home with them and put it to work?
You know, if there's one piece of advice I'd like you to take away from this session, it's to keep your eyes and ears open for opportunities from the past, because everybody seems to overlook this. I mean, if you look around you from reruns of old TV shows like I Love Lucy and Columbo to 1950s-style diners, everything is really fair game. Everything from the past is an opportunity for the future. And this is why the great books of the past, from the Greek philosophers to Napoleon Hill and Dale Carnegie, they continue to sell well even today. It's big business to republish books whose copyrights have expired. I know a lot of people that are in that business. And why is it such a great business? Well, for one thing, you don't have to pay advances or royalties. The authors are all dead, and the copyrights have run out. I think the huge success of ABC's Dancing with the Stars is another reminder to ignore the negativism of people who don't understand that most good ideas are reincarnated time and time again. And I'm sure there were a lot of skeptics when the idea of a show featuring ballroom dancing was first presented to network executives. So if you want to engage in some high-powered opportunity thinking, my advice is to try focusing some of your time on things that have worked well in the past, and people believe that the world has passed them by and has been proven time and time again. There's gold in successful products and services that were once big, but whose time has supposedly come and gone. All you need to add is resourcefulness and a novel marketing approach to recast an old idea into a modern-day winner. I don't care whether it's coffee shops or bookstores or diners or just about anything else, everything can be made to work just by adding a little different twist to it and by applying good marketing. You don't need to make things complicated. You know, every day all around me, I see endless opportunities for imaginative entrepreneurs to buck conventional wisdom and carve out a big slice of pie for themselves in all kinds of industries. And when everyone is shackled by conventional wisdom, it's really an open invitation for someone to come along and attract new customers by being a contrarian. If someone has tried something and failed at what you're contemplating, you know what I say? Great. Figure out why that person failed, then just try it a different way. I like to say that good hindsight leads to good foresight. If you take, for example, just one idea that you could connect to just about any business, it's customer service. Just think about all the robotic voicemails that everyone absolutely hates. You can go into just about any business and be customer service oriented, and you can make your theme, and I believe this is going to happen in the not too distant future. Your theme is when you call us, you talk to real live people who are going to answer the phone and say hello and help you with your problem. So put on your entrepreneur's cap here and think about this modern day nightmare for a moment. 100% of the buying public hates being victimized by the voicemail merry-go-rounds that virtually all companies now use, right? Which means that there are millions of very unhappy customers out there, and where there are unhappy customers, there are business opportunities. You kind of analogize it to the stock market. The customer service situation in businesses across the board has just about hit bottom. And what do you say about the stock market? At or near the bottom of a cycle is the best time to buy or to invest. So if you already own a business, I suggest it may be time to start thinking about investing in a live customer service department. It's going to cost a lot more money, but I think you'll make it up in sales many times over. And just use this service, this valuable service, as your most persuasive marketing tool and brag about it. I think it was a good note to end on, but just remember also that there's no such thing as an outdated business, that all you need to do is focus on something and doing it better or doing it different. Remember what Howard Schultz said about Starbucks? Our approach has been unique and different, not better, just different. So those are my parting words. There's gold in old ideas, old movies, old TV shows, old books, hamburgers, coffee shops, widgets, things that have been around forever. In fact, if a service or product has hit bottom, it might just be the perfect time for an entrepreneur with vision to revive it, recast it, and create a whole new and profitable industry in the process. Remember, the key is not whether an idea, product, or service is old or new, but how well one executes it, or as my dad used to say, man and method. And above all, my final words are, as I've said so often, be careful not to let the discouragement fraternity put a damper on your ideas and your vision. Because when people volunteer negative input, the one thing they almost never take into consideration is the vision, the resourcefulness, and the determination of the recasting entrepreneur. And I hope that'll be many, if not all, of the people on this line.
Well, Robert, I have to say that this has been one pleasurable, fun call to think about the different businesses, the enormous amount of information that you were able to bring up. It was a blast for me to be able to go back and forth with you on this as well. And so thank you for that opportunity. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you have enjoyed this session of recasting your business. There is a better way to build a mousetrap. You've heard it before, and I know that you can think of it. This is what makes business fun. You take what you got, you change it, you make something new, and we all make money. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's session of The Art of Recasting. If you are not already a subscriber to Robert Ringer's insightful e-letter, A Voice of Sanity in an Insane World, and would like to become one, please go to www.robertringer.com and click on the free e-letter on the home page. Thank you for being with us today. Robert and I look forward to being with you again soon.